You should have made your presence known.
Edward Cullen.
In the middle of that beautiful love scene? That wouldn't have been very tactful, would it?
The state has not produced one iota of medical evidence.
You were the last man in the world I could ever be prevailed upon to marry.
The Book Club.
Well, this is the second edition of the Nightlife Book Club, in which we're talking about a classic or well-known book that you might have read. And tonight, well, I just went and picked my favourite book, Wuthering Heights. I know there are a few of you Nightlife listeners who share my love for this classic. Now, it's one of the few books, of course, to have ever had a pop song written about it. And, of course, you'll get Kate Bush at the end of the conversation. And even if you haven't read it, you've heard of the protagonists, Kathy and Heathcliff, and you probably have a vision of this passionate love story set on the wild Yorkshire moors. Is it really a love story? Do you know, I thought it was when I was a teenager, but if any grown woman wants to put her hand up to be in a relationship with Heathcliff, then they need their head read. So what is the big lure? What is the attraction? What is so magnetic about this book? Well, if you're a fan, or even if you hated it and want to tell us why, I would love you to be a part of the book club. You can call 1-300-800-222. You can SMS on 0467-922-702. I'd really love to hear from you if for some reason you've read it for the first time, only very recently, and want to share your thoughts on it with us. Well, I haven't got a panel of impartial guests at all. Kate Forsyth is an Australian writer of historical fiction. She's a huge fan of the Bronte sisters. She travelled to see their childhood home in Yorkshire a few years ago. She says she rereads one of their novels every year. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Suzanne.
And I've also got Greg Carroll with me. Now, Greg is an actor and acclaimed theatre director, and he directed an adaptation of Wuthering Heights for the Australian Shakespeare Company in 2014. Hello, Greg.
Hello, Suzanne.
Well, Kate, I know that if you haven't read it, you might be a bit lost, so this is a challenge. I want to see if you can give us a relatively brief synopsis of the plot.
I will do my best for you, Suzanne. I think it's the complexity of the plot that actually frightens some people, but essentially it's a story of two love stories, one nested inside the other, two different generations. So in the first generation, we have Catherine Earnshaw and Heathcliff, who were raised as brother and sister, but fall passionately in love, are forced apart by cruel circumstance, and Catherine marries another. And then the second generation is their children, who play out this tragic love triangle of the first generation. But one ends tragically and the other ends happily.
And the second is very much the redemptive part of the story. Now, Greg, there is this idea that everyone has that Wuthering Heights is this wild and passionate book. What is it that makes it so wild and passionate?
Kathy makes it that way, and Heathcliff is her partner in it. It's so elemental. When I first read it, I think I was about 18 or 19, and I still had the teenage brain. And for me, it was just pure passion and wildness, and it just affected me considerably. And then years later, I was able to do a production of it, which was sort of like a lovely thing handed to me on a plate.
So, Kate, what took you to Wuthering Heights for the first time, and what was the immediate impact it had on you? It sounds like it had a big one on Greg.
It had the same impact on me as well, I must admit. So I first read it when I was 15. I read it as a consequence of Kate Bush and her song. The Wuthering and the, Kathy sobbing for her lover. I can remember the first time I read it just being completely kind of bewildered and, blown over by it. It was so full of tempestuous passions, and I didn't feel like I understood anything at all. I can remember it really appealed to that kind of wild, romantic teenage girl that I was. I think that, when you're a young woman, you want to be loved to madness. And then when you grow up, you find other ways of loving. I reread Wuthering Heights every 10 years. So I read it when I was 15, 25, 35, 45 and 55. And I've had a completely different reaction to it each time, which I find is part of its fascination, that there's so much in it, so many different ways of interpreting this story.
I wonder, Kate, because I read it when I was 16 or 17, and I literally bawled my eyes out for about 6 months. Every night I would read the passages that make me cry, and I would sob, and I would think about Kathy and Heathcliff and all this kind of thing. I wonder if you come to it for the first time when you're much older and you've actually been in love and you're not some, you know, teenager who fantasizes constantly. I wonder if, you know, you end up with a very different view and different love for it. I wonder what you think. I mean, you obviously also read it for the first time when you're in a teenager, though.
Well, I so agree with you, Suzanne. I've actually had this conversation with friends of mine. I think that for me, Wuthering Heights was my, you know, was the very first tragedy that I ever encountered. Up until then, I'd been reading childish books about childish things, and it was my launch pad into this idea of adult passions and the possibility of this storm of grief and loss and betrayal that is at the heart of the book. I think it really shocked me, but it also made me feel like I was grown up for the first time.
Yeah, that's a good point, isn't it? Now, Greg, I know when you think about Emily Bronte, you also think about Mary Shelley. Why are these two, you know, writers sort of connected for you?
I was just starting out at university, but I actually got involved with the Australian Performing Group, the Pram Factory in Melbourne. And the first play I went to see was Mary Shelley and the Monsters. And I really didn't know much about Mary Shelley. And I was absolutely blown away by it. And I've been involved in theatre ever since. I was blown away by it. And then I went and read Frankenstein. And then I realised, I can't remember exactly how old she was. I think she was only 17 or 18 when she wrote it. And I thought, my God, what was in the water? And then I came to, through Charles Dickens and through that, I came to Wuthering Heights and had the same effect on me. It was just that destructive love and intense hatred, those dynamic elements in the book. And, oh, my God, it blew me away. And even at that stage, I was doing a lot of running, and I started running really late at night, imagining I was Kathy and Heathcliff running through the woods. Yeah. I had a lot of Tiranas and cars chasing me, but they couldn't catch me.
Yeah, one of my texters, Kaz, said, I love Wuthering Heights. A friend of mine and I acted out the famous scene in Yorkshire when we did the Bronte tour. She said, Kaz says, I'm a librarian and would-be writer. Gosh, Greg, I love the picture of you there.
Well, that was the beauty. Yeah, that was the beauty of the production is that you stay true to the novel, but you've got to make it physical. You've got to make the characters alive, three dimensional, and that is quite exciting, because the book is structured in a way of storytelling and all of those. It's beautiful, but when you do it on stage, you've really got to do it rather than say you did it. So that's the aspect. So I had the great pleasure of creating a Catherine and a Heathcliff and an Edgar and all of those characters. And it was so exciting. It really was. And then to do it outdoors, I had to adapt it to the outdoors. And what better to do Wuthering Heights than everywhere where there's Wuthering? I mean, so it was fascinating. Under the stars, and then one night we had a storm. We went ahead because it was just perfect for it.
Yeah. When you're casting a Heathcliff, do you really need someone who can really put on that nasty edge? I remember Cliff Richard once saying he'd love to have a go at Heathcliff. I'm just thinking, nah, I just don't think he's kind of got what it takes to be Heathcliff, because Heathcliff is a violent, nasty character. Yeah.
In 1973, I think Keith might have been able to do it. But I actually used an actor called Michael Waugh, who's been doing quite a few things with the Melbourne Theatre Company and the STC. And he's very dark, very handsome, and he was perfect, Heathcliff. And he grabbed hold of the role and did a wonderful performance of it. He had those wonderful dark, smoky look you know, and it was it just suited the production down to a T.
Yeah,
he didn't hold back. He didn't hold back in it whatsoever, which was great.
Yeah, we are doing a book club here on Night Live, and I would love it if you have any thoughts that you would like to share about Wuthering Heights. Did you love it? Did you hate it? Why did you love it? Owen's on the line. He's going to give me his 2 cents worth on Wuthering Heights in just a moment. But Kate, one of the questions I'm really interested in is whether Wuthering Heights is a love story or something else entirely. I said when I was younger and completely obsessed with it, I compared it quite unfavourably with Jane Eyre because I thought Jane Eyre, look, this is really staid. Wuthering Heights is so wild and unbridled. And I marvelled at how, you know, Emily Bronte, who had never had a relationship, could have written this powerful love story. But of course, now I'm older, I think Emily could imagine a story like that partially because she hadn't been in love. And Charlotte gave us the story that was actually much more rooted in reality. I mean, Kate, do you think it is actually a love story?
I do think it's a love story, but it's not only a love story. Like, if I was to describe it, I would say it's a story of love and hate, and that it's a story of obsession and revenge. And I do think it's a story about cruelty. I think that at the heart of the story, it's about how Heathcliff was twisted awry by the cruelty that was done to him. And then he determines to enact that cruelty upon others, upon the children of his hated rivals. And that includes Catherine's brother as well as her husband, because, you know, what people tend to forget is that Heathcliff was raised as Cathy's brother. He was adopted into the family. And so Cathy's elder brother was also Heathcliff's elder brother, and it's that betrayal and that cruelty which I think is at the heart of the book.
What about you, Greg? Do you think it's a love story?
Yes, I do, as much as there are many forms of love. And in this one, it has all the right elements for attracting you to what's dangerous. And the love is supercharged. It's not just like this is what you just said before was perfect, that in a sense she'd never really experienced it, so she could imagine it. And so in this case, her book, the imagining and the supercharged feelings, there's no room for half measures in this novel. It's like you jump into the driver's seat and you push the pedal to the metal or something, and off you go. And there's no holding back. And I think the way that it does jump, like Kate said, it's the cruelty in it is phenomenal. It's sensational, really. And that these characters, the violence from Hindley towards Heathcliff, even towards Cathy, you know, really. You want to jump up and punch him in the nose, but
course, there's something very Freudian about it.
I think there is.
It's pre-Freud, and that's one of the reasons why it's so fascinating. I think is that you can see these incredibly intense, dark human emotions played out in this very kind of claustrophobic and incestuous stage.
Mm.
Wonderful. Let me bring a couple of listeners in. Hello, Owen.
Yes, good evening, Suzanne, and to your guests, Kate and Greg. Yes, I am actually in the unique position where, guess what, I'm in the book club too, and we're reading Wuthering Heights store next week.
Oh,
and
are you so really?
I'm reading it for the first time, so I'll add the qualification. I haven't finished it yet. But so far, I'm enjoying it. But one of the things that struck me as interesting is the characters in the book. Like in other books, like, say, Pride and Prejudice or something like that, you know, you had characters who all had their flaws, but some of them you sort of develop a fondness for. You can see yourself cheering them on in a way. Well, for this one, I'm so far finding it very hard to like anyone, and I think this is one of Emily Bronte's strengths, that she makes all the characters, even if you can feel sorrow to them or pity to them at some stages during the novel, she makes all the characters, their flaws evident. There's no real sort of perfect characters. Even Lockwood and Nellie Dean, the two narrators of the story, if you look at how Nellie treats Heathcliff when he first comes into the house, she actually leads him on the steps in the hope that he'll wander off and get lost, and then for the first 2 years of his existence, he does things
that's,
like...
that's right, Owen. It is really cruelty upon cruelty, isn't it? I'm so glad there's that wonderful coincidence there, Owen, that you're reading it at the same time. Now, Kate, I want you to take us through the reaction that Wuthering Heights had when it was released. You know, Emily Bronte's own sister, Charlotte, wrote a preface, which was basically an apology for the book. There was some horrendous press, wasn't there?
Yeah, there absolutely was. So the preface that was written by Charlotte Bronte was written after Emily's death, and it was an apology in many, many ways for, you know, some of what was seen as a coarseness. At that time, the identity of Emily Bronte was unknown. She was still anonymously published under the gender-neutral name of Ellis Bell. But even so, there was this, you know, I mean, Dante Gabriel Rossetti said it was a fiend of a book, an incredible monster, you know, and Dante Gabriel Rossetti was not known for, you know, for being conservative. So it really did have this huge effect. I think it shocked this sort of pious, you know, Victorian society. It's kind of, you know, late Victorian society or early Victorian society. It shocked it because it kind of went against this idea of the English countryside as this kind of bucolic, beautiful place of peace and where, you know, lovely things happened. It really rattled the English idea of themselves, and I find that really fascinating.
I want you both to tell me about particular parts of the book which just really hit you with a sledgehammer or have stayed with you, some of the lines and the moments. Greg, why don't I start with you, because you've got what is probably one of the more controversial.
Yes, When I go through the novel, there are many, many parts that I really love. But it was interesting your caller before, because the thing is, it is a gothic novel. And I mean, because, and she creates this wonderful sense of, like we were saying before, of monstrosity. And it is about monsters. And I remember that there was one great moment at the end of the book. There's two great moments at the end of the book, but one of them was with Heathcliff when he decides to dig up Cathy. You know, he goes to the grave and gets the I can't remember what he was called. The man who looks after the
Undertaker.
Yes, that'll do. And he gets him to open her coffin so he can stare down at her and he wants to be in that grave with her. Do you want me to read a little
bit? Yes, I do.
This is where Nellie is. It's the sexton he's called. I should have remembered that. I'll tell you what I did yesterday. I got the sexton who was digging Linton's grave to remove the earth off her coffin lid, and I opened it. I thought once I would have stayed there. When I saw her face again, it is hers yet. He had hard work to stir me. But he said it would change if the air blew on it. And so I struck one side of the coffin loose and covered it up. Not Linton's side, damn him, I wished he'd been soldered in lead. And I bribed the sexton to pull it away. And when I'm laid there and slide mine out too, I'll have it made so. And then by the time Linton gets to us, he'll not know which is which. You are very wicked, Mr. Heathcliff, I exclaimed. You are not ashamed to disturb the dead. I disturbed nobody, Nellie, he replied, and I gave some ease to myself. I shall be great deal more comfortable now, and you'll have a better chance of keeping me underground when I get there. Disturbed her? No, she has disturbed me night and day through 18 years incessantly, remorsefully. Yet yesternight, and yesternight I was tranquil. I dreamt I was sleeping the last sleep by that sleeper, with my heart stopped and my cheek frozen against hers, of dissolving with her and being more happy still.
Oh, gosh.
There you go.
Just hearing it again, you just hear the power. That was amazing, Greg.
And yeah.
Now, Kate, I don't know if you can top that.
Sorry.
I have to say that I love that passage as well. There's something so eerie and chilling about it, and the idea of his cheek frozen to hers. But I think that I can top it. But the scene I love the most is probably the most famous scene in the whole book. And I can remember when I first read it, the actual physical shock that it gave me, it just came out of nowhere and completely kind of altered the dynamics of the story. So it happens right at the beginning of the book. Would you like me to read it to you?
Please do.
So the book begins when Lockwood, a fairly ordinary man, finds himself staying in the house, Wuthering Heights, overnight because he's been marooned there by a terrible storm, and he can't sleep because of the sound of the storm wuthering around this house. So he starts reading Kathy's diary, and then he kind of falls into a half doze, but he can't sleep because he can hear this bow rattling against the window constantly. So I'll just begin to read. It annoyed me so much that I resolved to silence it if possible. And, I thought, I rose and endeavoured to unhasp the casement. The hook was soldered into the staple, a circumstance observed by me when awake but now forgotten. I must stop it, nevertheless, I muttered, knocking my knuckles through the glass and stretching an arm out to seize the importunate branch, instead of which my fingers closed on the fingers of a little ice-cold hand. The intense horror of nightmare came over me. I tried to draw back my arm, but the hand clung to it, and a most melancholy voice sobbed, "Let me in! Let me in!" "Who are you?" I asked, struggling meanwhile to disengage myself. "Catherine Linton," it replied shiveringly. "I've come home. I'd lost my way on the moor." As it spoke, I discerned obscurely a child's face looking through the window. Terror made me cruel, and finding it useless to attempt shaking the creature off, I pulled its wrist onto the broken pane and rubbed it to and fro till the blood ran down and soaked the bedclothes. Still it waved, "Let me in," and maintained its tenacious grip, almost maddening me with fear.
Oh, and of course, they're the words we hear in Kate Bush's song, you know,
let me in.
Anne from Randwick is going to join us quickly. Then I might do my favourite verse, my favourite bit, if I'm allowed to. Hello, yep. Anne.
Hi, Suzanne and guests. Greg, can I just say to you first, I was really grateful in the film Mary Shelley when Mary said to Percy, "You're a romantic and you always see the optimistic side of things, but I always see the pessimistic side of things." And that's what allowed her to write Frankenstein, that those two elements are two sides of the one coin.
All right. Now, Anne, let's have your comments on Wuthering Heights.
Wuthering Heights, I agree with you, Suzanne. I compared it to Jane Eyre a lot when I was a teenager, but I really found the weather and the landscape so pervasive, and I thought about it for months after I read the book at school, because it was the first time, like the wind and the elements, the barrenness of the Yorkshire moors, it makes the book more cruel with the weather and the landscape.
Yeah, it'd be hard to imagine that kind of cruelty being inflicted in a much more benign kind of environment, wouldn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. All right, Anne, thank you very much. All right. Well, it's probably a bit self-indulgent of me, but as we all did our favourite passages, this is one of mine, although I used to know the scenes around Kathy's death off by heart and recite them constantly. But for me, there's this part where she's sort of nearing her death and she suddenly sort of has this epiphany and sort of says, you know, in leaving Wuthering Heights, in turning my back on Heathcliff, I've more or less given up everything that made me me, and now I have to find a way to get back to Wuthering Heights. And she's looking out of the window and she sees Wuthering Heights in the distance and she says, Joseph sits up late, doesn't he? He's waiting till I come home that he may lock the gate. Well, he'll wait a while yet. It's a rough journey and a sad heart to travel it. And we must pass by Gimmet and Kirk to go that journey. That's the graveyard, basically. We've braved its ghosts often together and dared each other to stand among the graves and ask them to come. But Heathcliff, if I dare now, will you venture? If you do, I'll keep you. I'll not lie there by myself. They may bury me 12 feet deep and throw the church down over me, but I won't rest till you are with me. I never will. So, I love all the passages we've picked. Oh, gosh, I need to go and reread it. Stat. Yeah. Thank you so much for being part of our book club tonight. I mean, maybe just one final comment. I mean, you know, is what the value of Wuthering Heights still controversial, or do we all? Is it all really considered like this is an amazing, brilliant book that deserves to be a classic in the canon? Kate,
I think it's a very divisive book. I think that's one of the reasons why it's so fascinating. I have friends who hate it and find the cruelty in it unforgivable. And I have other friends who simply find it too baffling and they find it too hard to, you know, all the doubling up of the characters, you know, so many characters with the same names and who married who and who is related to who. They find it too confusing. So I think it's a very divisive book, and I think that nowadays when we have much different ideas about gender politics and the roles of men and women in their relationships, I think a lot of young women find it suffocatingly chilling story about a woman who's basically torn apart by men.
Wow. All right, Greg, a final comment from you.
Oh, look, I agree. I think you can, no matter what book you look at, you'll always find a different and things change with time and people have different ideas. But, you know, I think Kate mentioned earlier, one really interesting thing is that the book does end on a really high note. And I remember the one, I haven't got that in front of me at the moment, but I remember Nellie says something like, this is Hareton and Kathy too, when this is the next generation. And I'll never forget Nellie said, they are afraid of nothing. Together they would brave Satan and all his legions. And then later on you get Lockwood goes visits the gravesite. But I thought that was just magnificent. So for all of the pain and suffering and the rawness of it, in the end we have a peace. It resolves. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being part of our Nightlife Book Club tonight. Kate Forsyth, an Australian writer of historical fiction, big Bronte fan. Kate, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure.
And Greg Carroll, actor and acclaimed theatre director who directed an adaptation of Wuthering Heights for the Australian Shakespeare Company in 2014. Thank you, Greg.
Great. Thank you very much. It's been great fun.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.